The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So my name is Andrea, for those of you who I've not met before. Tonight I'd like to talk about what we add to our experience. There's actually a lot of ways that our minds add things to our experience. We add things that we like. We add liking, we add not liking, we add reactivity, we add emotional reactivity. We add views, opinions, beliefs. So it's very rare, actually, that our minds are experiencing what's actually happening in the world. We're usually adding something else to it. And so tonight I'd like to talk about some of the things that we add to our experience and how that adding is very tied up with the ways that we struggle, the ways that we suffer, the ways that we feel dissatisfaction or unhappiness in our lives, that this process of adding to our experience is very tied up with that. And also talk a little bit about how we can use mindfulness to support exploring this and learning about the things, how that learning about the ways we add things can help to free us from those things, help us to understand them more clearly. So the first thing I'd like to talk about is a way that the Buddha actually pointed to the ways that we add to our experience. In one of his discourses, he said to his followers, he said, "So what's the difference between an ordinary person who experiences pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral experience and a person who has some understanding, some wisdom? What's the difference between these two? They'll both experience pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral experience. So what's the difference between them?" And he answered his own question by saying, "When the ordinary person is contacted by a painful feeling, he sorrows, grieves, and laments, weeps, beating his breast, and becomes distraught. He feels two feelings, a bodily one and a mental one." And he goes along to give an analogy. He says, "Suppose they were to strike someone with a dart, and then they were to just strike them immediately afterwards with a second dart. So that person would feel two feelings, caused pain caused by two darts." So likewise, he says that with the ordinary person, there is the initial feeling of painful feeling, and then there's all the stuff we add to it. For a person who is wise, he says, when a person who is wise is contacted by a painful feeling, that person does not sorrow, grieve, or lament, does not weep, beating their breast, and become distraught. They feel one feeling, a bodily feeling, not a mental one. So he points to the fact that when we relate to things in our ordinary ways, when we feel something painful, we'll add on top of it. We'll add reactivity on top of it. We don't like it. We want to get rid of it. We feel like we've done something wrong, like we've failed. There's all kinds of reactivity that we add on top of unpleasant feeling. We do this with pleasant feeling too. When there's pleasant feeling, we like it, we want it, we want to have more of it, we want to hold on to it. If it slips through our fingers, we think we've done something wrong. So there's with the meeting of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feeling, there is very often additions. We add on top of it. So part of what we begin to look at here is to recognize that the experience that we're having and the reaction to it are two different things. We sometimes can see that they're different things, but they're so tightly intertwined that we sometimes don't think we have a choice about our reactions. It's like, well, when that happens, that's the way I react. And there's it's like we don't think there's any way out of it. So we can begin to see that this belief that there's no way out of our reactivity, that it's kind of just has to follow, by beginning to pay attention to our experience. We turn our attention to the reactivity. We turn our attention to the feelings that we're having. And by that exploration, we begin to see that they are different things and that there is something of a choice involved in reacting. It's hard to see. It's hard to see that choice. But the first way we can begin to explore it is by seeing when we're having a reaction to some experience, seeing if we cannot act out on that reaction. That's the first place we can explore a choice around our reactions. To see if we can, just instead of reacting to it, instead of acting out on our reactions, see if we can turn and meet that feeling with attention, with mindfulness. Now, I know when I first heard this instruction, I thought, why? Why would I do that? You know, I'm angry about something. Why would I turn and feel my anger? Why would I pay attention to my anger? Won't that just make me more angry? That was what I thought. But actually what happens, if we're having an experience about something, often it's an experience, we're reacting to something, it's often we're reacting to something that's happening out there, often. I mean, it might be that we're reacting to something in our bodies, but there seems to be a kind of a split. We seem to think, this is happening to me somehow. So that, you know, we're reacting to something that's happening to me. And in that, when we put our attention on the thing that we're reacting to, whether it's somebody cutting us off on the freeway or whether it's a painful body sensation, if we put our attention in the thing that we're reacting to, that tends to feed the reactivity. So what the suggestion is to turn to the reactivity itself. So thereby taking our attention out of the thing that's kind of causing the reaction. That's the first kind of step in exploring this. That we start to see that it's possible to turn towards the reaction itself. And in that exploration, as I saw when I first began trying this, looking at anger, it surprised me that it didn't just make me more angry. In fact, it kind of made it possible for me to let it go when I began to turn and look at that anger. So there I began to see a choice, that there was a little bit of a choice involved in that reactivity. So with this exploration, you know, sometimes we can get attached to our reactivity. You know, if we think about the ways that we react to things, you know, like, you know, if somebody, there's so much of a range of reactivity. You know, if somebody cuts us off on the freeway, there may be a reaction from mild to severe. Or, you know, there may be reactivity to losing a job, and depending on future job prospects, again, the range of reactivity may be stronger or not so strong. The loss of a partner to a terminal illness, usually that's going to be a very strong reaction. Now, I think a lot of us, you know, if we could imagine being non-reactive to our experience, you know, we could imagine being non-reactive to somebody cutting us off on the freeway. That might sound pretty good, you know, that if we could be completely non-reactive to kind of this external people doing things around us. But when it comes to being non-reactive to losing a job or to losing a partner, somehow we think that feels a little off. You know, that we think if we're not reacting to those kinds of experiences, then we're inhuman somehow. You know, that it's that our reactivity to those kinds of experiences proves that we care, proves that we're connected. So this is a kind of a belief we have around some kinds of reactivity, and it's worth exploring. Because I'd like to propose that there's a possibility. I mean, what we think of non-reactivity, I think we think of being flat, being non-responsive. But reactivity is the kind of the form of reactivity takes is that there's a non-acceptance of what's happening. That the mind is rebelling against what's happening. That it's saying, this is not okay. So there's a kind of an aversion, a pushing away, or there's something that says, no, I've got to have this, I've got to hold on to this. So there's this movement of greed or aversion happening in reactivity. And what I'd like to suggest is there's a possibility when that greed and aversion falls away. You know, if the heart is open and greed and aversion fall away when something really challenging happens, the loss of a job or the loss of a partner, the open heart can meet that situation without reactivity, without greed, aversion, or delusion, and responds instead with a kind of a resonance to the suffering. We resonate with compassion and with equanimity. So there's the non-reactive mind isn't flat. It's not indifferent. In fact, it cares more deeply because it can meet experience. Because it's not recoiling from experience. Because it's not saying, I can't stand this. It's able to open and meet experience. So it's a different, it's like a turning of the mind to imagine that possibility of the heart being able to be non-reactive. So when we are mindful of our reactivity, this is the kind of pathway to finding our way to non-reactivity. It sounds like a bit of a paradox. But that's what I've seen in my own experience. You know, when I turn to look at my anger, it helps me to understand a lot of things about that anger. One of the main things it helped me to understand was this is suffering. And that the mind was contributing to that. That it was something in the mind, some rebelling, some recoiling, some, this is not good, this is not right. That was part and parcel of that anger. So the add-ons, this is not good, this is not right. The add-ons create that suffering, create that reactivity. So as we turn to our reactivity, turn to explore it, we find that gradually the mind starts to understand this process of how this reactivity is created. However you are reactive, it's not just around anger, it's whatever kind of reactivity there is. Your mind starts to understand that and begins to slowly, slowly over time, let go, start to let go of that reactivity. It takes time, this willingness to turn and meet our reactivity as a form of letting go of it. It's not usually a fast process. It's something that happens really gradually, kind of bit by bit. There's a analogy that the Buddha uses around how this mindfulness practice works for us. And I love this analogy because sometimes, you know, we have this idea about, I went into the mindfulness, it's like enlightenment, yes, enlightenment, that's what I want. And it's like, that's going to solve my problems. And it's going to happen in a blinding flash. And then after that, everything's going to be okay. That's kind of how I thought this was going to go. But what I discovered is that it doesn't go that way. It's really gradual. And the Buddha gives an analogy about this. He says, you know, that think about a shipwreck. Think about a a shipwreck, and there's all these parts of the ship strewn all over the beach. And over the time, the sun, the sand, the wind kind of wear away at the parts of the ship. You know, the rope, the boards, everything, you know. So the sun and the sand and the wind are wearing those down. And if you look at those parts day by day, you're not going to see much change. But a year later, you go and you try to pick up one of those ropes, it may fall apart in your hand. And you see that over time, very gradually, that the sun and the sand and the wind have rotted away that rope. And mindfulness does that to our reactivity in a gradual way. Little by little, it wears it down. So this reactivity to pleasant, unpleasant in particular, then there's neutral. There's also reactivity to neutral, which I haven't talked much about. But in this there's kind of we disconnect. We don't really notice things that are neutral. So there's a little bit, it seems like it's a kind of a reverse reactivity in a way, because we're just not paying attention to it at all. So this is one of the ways in which we add to our experience. It's possible to meet our experience, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, as just, this is just pleasant experience. This is unpleasant experience. It's not picking up that extra dart and stabbing ourselves a second time, or a third time, or a fifth time, or an 18th time. We react to our reactions, and there's this cascading cycle. So this is one of the main ways that we add to our experience, not being able to meet things as they are. So beginning to explore this, and through exploring the reactivity itself is a really helpful way to look into this and begin to see it releasing. If you have some, even a little bit of confidence or willingness to explore that, I think you will see the benefits of it. It took a couple of months for me to really, really get the benefits of this turning towards the experience. And I saw it improve. I mean, I saw the change of the benefits little by little, but you know, after a few months it was really clear to me how it was helpful. There's no question in my mind that this was a pathway to becoming free of that reactivity. So another way that we add to our experience is by adding views and beliefs. And this one's a little bit more kind of under the covers, you know, it's a little bit more hidden in our kind of unconscious sometimes, what our beliefs are, what our views are. But we can actually uncover them by simply checking in. You know, what do I believe here? You know, we can actually check in and ask ourselves that question. And often there will be some kind of a clue of what our beliefs are. So there's a lot of different ways we add with respect to beliefs. Some of them are ways that we've constructed over our lives, and others are ways that our society has given to us. You know, so for instance, we might have personal views of how a partner should behave, or how our sons and daughters should be. You know, we might have personal views about that. They should do that. They shouldn't do that. A daughter of mine would never do that. Well, there she is, doing that. So these personal beliefs, and then there are, you know, kind of societal views that relate to us personally, like, so for instance, something like, I have something, therefore I deserve it. Or I don't have something, and so I don't deserve to have that. Those kinds of thoughts may be kind of hidden in our subconscious. Views of, you know, if I don't get what I want, I'm a failure. That kind of thing. If I don't get this job, then it means I'm a loser. These are the kinds of beliefs we have. And then there are kind of more pervasive views kind of coming from our society. For example, one, America is the land of opportunity. Anyone who works hard enough can live their dream. Kind of a view of our culture. And it, this view actually leads to a kind of a classic problem in our society around privilege. That for some people that may be true, but for a whole class of people, the conditions of society have not provided them with the ability, no matter how hard they work. There's all these, there are kind of hidden ways in which the opportunities are closed because of race, because of sexual orientation, because of all kinds of prejudices. So what's the problem with views? I mean, some of what I've just said kind of highlights it, highlights some of the problems. But if we even think just about our own personal views, you know, views of who we are, think for yourself, what's a view you have of yourself, you know? Often these views, I mean, we know when other people have opinions about us, oh, well, that person just does that kind of thing. You know, we feel boxed in, we feel limited by that. It's like, well, they don't understand who I am, you know? I'm more than that. But we do that same thing to ourselves. We have views of ourselves and we limit ourselves. We box ourselves in. So part of the difficulty with views is that they're limiting. Now, I'm not saying that views are all bad. But what we need to do is to uncover them. To not just operate blindly out of our views and beliefs, but to begin to reveal themselves to us. You know, that if we can begin to see what our views and beliefs are, we can begin to question them and not just act based on those views and beliefs. So one of the famous quotes of the Buddha, I love this quote, "Those people attached to views roam the world offending people." That the, you know, when we're tightly attached to views, when we're tightly attached to some way that we believe things are or should be, we're not very flexible around meeting other people with other views. So pretty much any time there's a kind of suffering going on, any kind of struggle going on, there's some kind of view operating. So this is an interesting thing to explore. If there's some kind of challenge in your life happening, look for what the views and beliefs are around it. So I'm going to give you, you know, a common view, one common view that leads to suffering. It's not supposed to be like this. Underlying that, I mean, so there's that view of whatever's happening, it's not supposed to be like this. And sometimes underlying that view is some kind of a belief that makes it even more of a struggle for us. So there's enough of a struggle around this idea of it's not supposed to be like this, because we feel like, you know, it's not supposed to be like this. We're in that reactive mode to what's happening. So there's already that reactivity. But then often underlying that view, it's not supposed to be like this, there's other things going on. That if it's like this, it means I'm a failure. It means I'm not lovable. It means I don't try hard enough. It means I'm not as good as other people. So there's some, you know, self-belief that happens often that feels kind of threatening to us when we have that view, it's not supposed to be like this. Often that it's not supposed to be like this is actually born out of those other beliefs. So beginning to uncover our beliefs, asking ourselves, what do I believe right now? You know, starting to check in. What are the beliefs operating, especially when you're suffering? What do I believe needs to happen? What do I believe needs to stop happening? What are the facts of the situation, and what are the beliefs involved? That's a really helpful thing to explore. You know, for example, you know, you might be at work and somebody makes a face at you. And, you know, what do you do with that? What does your mind do with that? Somebody making a face at you. Is it just, you know, you think, oh, that person must have indigestion? Or do you think that person doesn't like me? You know, so look at what your mind does and see if you can begin to tease out the actual experience from the beliefs. Now, you know, suppose this person, you know, another thing to do is to look even more deeply, you know, so this person made a face at you and you have the belief this person doesn't like me. What happens if that's true? What are the beliefs under there? That if this person doesn't like me, what does that mean? I mean, that's yet more beliefs. Does it cause suffering if there is that, if it's true that person doesn't like me? What are the beliefs there? I mean, it may be that you form beliefs, well, this person doesn't like me, so that person must be stupid. Or this person doesn't like me, so I'm not likable. There's all kinds of different ways. Or I'm not doing something right if that person doesn't like me. So what are the beliefs underlying? Now, you know, we cannot, I mean, we usually can't just, even uncovering our beliefs, you know, we uncover our beliefs, we may begin to see, wow, you know, I feel like I'm not likable if somebody doesn't like me. You know, if we uncover that belief, it's unlikely that we can simply say, oh, well, that belief's silly, let me just let that one go. We rarely can, you know, just put them aside like that. But we can observe that this is how we are. I mean, so we can begin to observe what are the beliefs we are acting from and begin to understand what are the consequences of that. What are the consequences of that belief? So starting to take, have some curiosity around our views. Again, the exploration here to begin to see, oh, here are these views, here are these beliefs. The actual seeing of them somehow begins to loosen the stickiness they have. Slowly, slowly, over time, they can loosen the stickiness of these kinds of beliefs. Now, I had a real strong belief around self-hatred. You know, that there would be all kinds of thoughts in my mind, you're no good, you're a failure. And those thoughts were so potent in my mind because I believed that I was no good. I mean, that I really had that self-hatred underlying those thoughts. And, you know, so I really worked with this for a long time, exploring both the thoughts and the belief, the feeling of the self-hatred, you know, willingness to meet that. It was a challenging exploration, but very fruitful over time. Very fruitful over time. And this, you know, the way, for me, the way it kind of let go was through starting to see that the thoughts that were coming up, you know, oh, you're no good, you're a failure. Those thoughts, they were just thoughts. To really see that, oh, that's just a thought. and that it didn't have any inherent validity. That began to undermine the belief in the self-hatred. So again, you know, we can turn towards all of these things. Mindfulness is very powerful. So our beliefs also can underlie the movement to reactivity from pleasant and unpleasant. You know, that, you know, you see something you like, you want it, oh, I need that. You know, that there's somehow, like commercials are a great example of this, you know, they create a situation in which we think we need something. So there's something pleasant there, but then they also tap into that kind of belief that there's a need. So looking into what are beliefs around reactivity as well. That if there's suffering going on, there is some kind of belief operating. And then the last way I'll talk about adding things in is with concepts. So this is an even subtler form of adding in to our experience, ways that we don't actually meet things the way they are. So concepts are related to a very natural process in our mind, that we recognize things, we perceive things. You know, when I look out at this room, I see man and woman, I see chairs and carpets and walls and lights. And so there's all of these things that I'm seeing through concept, basically. And this part of the mind that does, concept is really useful. You know, if I had to come into a room every time and figure out, oh, that's a chair, it would be a really long process to navigate the world. So it's very useful, this process of concept. But we mistake this. We mistake the concept for the actual thing, the actuality. So we tend to do that. We tend to take our concepts for the actual experience. So just as an exploration of this, you know, if you just hold out your hand and look at your hand, and, you know, it's a hand, right? You know, you look at it as a hand. So it's a hand there. And then I'd like to ask you to attend to the feelings of your hand. Let go, even close your eyes for a second and feel the feeling in your hand. Vibration, tingling, pulsing, pressure, heat, coolness. Feeling those sensations. And then open your eyes again and look at your hand as a hand. Does it shift your connection with that experience? For me, I find when I look at it as a hand, it kind of distances me from the actual experience of the hand. We do that all the time. We live our lives through our concepts without realizing that's what we're doing. So this is a pretty subtle kind of adding in. You know, it's a very natural way that we add to our experience, in that, you know, if our minds didn't do this, we wouldn't be able to navigate the world very well. But it's the mistaking the concept for reality where we can get into trouble. I'll give you an example of this, and this kind of seeing how it gets us into trouble is most clear when we see that our process of perception makes a mistake, because this perceptual process is not perfect by any means. It is a you know, it's kind of like a rough pattern matching algorithm that works really well. You know, it identifies, it matches things to what we've known before. So there's you know, I've seen lots of chairs in my life, you know, so that's a chair. So there's, you know, this kind of pattern matching thing that goes on. We experience something and the mind really quickly goes back and says, where have I seen something like that before? Oh, it's that. Okay, that's what that is. So this process can make a mistake. So one example of this from my own experience, I was in Burma. Some of you know have heard this story. And this monastery that I was in was really close to a village. So, you know, the village sounds came wafting into the monastery. Loudspeakers and lots of sound. Monasteries are not quiet in Burma. So there was a lot of sound. And every evening around the same time, right around dusk, there would be a squealing sound. And whenever I heard the squealing sound, the image that came into my mind was a pig. And the squealing had a kind of a distraught sound to it in my mind. And so my mind created this concept that I was in a dorm that was very near the village butcher. And this pig was, there were pigs each evening being slaughtered for the village. That is what my mind did with this sound. The result of that was that I felt compassion for the pig that was being slaughtered. This went on for a long time, several weeks, I think. It seemed very regular. And then one evening, instead of meditating in my room at that time, I was out walking. I was doing walking meditation at that time. And I noticed there were all these things that were flying around. There were all these bats flying around. And they were squealing. So I saw in that instant, it's like, oh, that wasn't a pig being slaughtered. It was bats flying around. So that immediately changed my response, of course. I mean, it was a much more neutral response. It's just bats, you know. There's no pig being murdered. So, you know, we can see how we often will react to our ideas. I mean, when it makes a mistake, it becomes really clear that we're reacting to an idea, not the reality. That was very clear to me in that situation, that I was reacting, responding in a way, because my heart was open, so it was a compassionate response, but it was based in misperception. So we can begin to look at our reactivity. This is a really great exploration around reactivity. What are we actually reacting to? Are we reacting to what's actually there, or are we reacting to an idea? Another example from my own practice, this one where there's less misperception, but very clear that I was reacting to an idea rather than the experience. Same monastery, different year. I had bed bugs. So I was getting bitten by bed bugs regularly. And they're quite a pain, these bed bugs. And my mind just went nuts. There's an incredible reactivity to this. It's like, oh, I'm going to take them home with me. It's going to be a disaster. I'm going to get them in my house. What am I going to do? You know, so the mind was proliferating around the bed bugs. When I saw, I mean, basically, I saw that the reactivity was happening around the idea, rather than the actual experience, which was a little bit of itching from time to time. And when I saw that, I was kind of like, what I saw was happening was that I was picking up everything that I thought I was going to have to do between then and, you know, a month from now in order to keep myself from getting bed bugs in my house. I was picking it all up at once, and it was like, oh, I can't deal with this. It's too much. It's too hard. It's like, it's just some itching now, and, you know, I wash everything. You know, it's just step by step. So look in your experience and see, what is it that you're actually reacting to? Is it an actual experience, or is it a concept? The last piece around concept, and I'm not going to go into this in great detail, but just to kind of put it out there, because I feel like this talk wouldn't be complete without putting this piece out there in terms of something we add to our experience. And that is that the concept of self is the most kind of fundamental add-in that we do. And it is an add-on. It's something that we're adding to our experience. It's like the concept of hand, that when we see our experience through this concept of self, we are at a remove from what's actually happening. So the Buddha actually suggested the way to explore this is just to look at what we're adding to experience, any kind of adding to experience. He gave an instruction to one monk. He said, "You should train yourself like this. In reference to the seen, there will be only the seen. In reference to the heard, there will be only the heard. In reference to the sensed, only the sensed. In reference to the cognized, only the cognized. This is how you should train yourself." So he basically said, train yourself by noticing what's actually happening. See if there is any add-on. Just train yourself that way. Look at what the experience is. See the reaction. See what's added. He goes on from there. He says, when for you there will be only the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard in reference to the heard, only the sensed in reference to the sensed, only the cognized in reference to the cognized, then there will be no you in terms of that. When there is no you in terms of that, there is no you there. When there is no you there, you are neither here nor yonder nor between the two. This is the end of stress. So he's pointing to, you know, this truth around self being basically a concept, not a reality. He says this will be revealed to us as we explore our experience. It's not something we have to believe. It's not something we have to try to do. It's not something we have to try to get rid of, our idea of self. It needs to just be seen through, in the seen is only the seen. We don't need to try to figure it out or even believe it. Just be willing to see, what are you adding? What are you adding to your experience? So that's, I think, enough for me. Any comments or questions? Yeah.
So this brings to mind an experience I've had of late where I'll have sensations in my body, discomfort in particular, and I find I react to them because they are very similar to how I feel when I'm upset. And I feel these feelings, therefore I must be upset.
That's a great thing to see. What have you done with that if you've noticed that?
Try to pay attention. Well, it's very confusing, First of all, because I find myself, my mind and my emotions, because what I notice is there's this discomfort or, you know, very uncomfortable physical feeling, and then I start to feel anxious or, you know.
Yes.
And I'm noticing this sort of escalation, you know, that is based on a bad conclusion.
Yes.
And
possibly even an erroneous one.
Yes. And then, you know, I have various degrees of success in short-circuiting that and mm-hmm. basically saying, no, you know, you just have an upset stomach. No, it's just, you know,
yes. uh-huh.
this other kind of feeling, and then try to just deal with it on that level. And,
yes.
And just say, it's just bad feelings. Uh-huh. It's just, you know, the uncomfortableness in your stomach.
And how does that, you say you're having varying levels of ability to do that?
Or? Yeah, because uh-huh. sometimes it depends on how far the emotional escalation has gotten,
yes.
because that produces physiological results as
Absolutely.
Well. And then sometimes those are sort of self-supporting. And,
yes.
And even if you're aware of them, it can still be disconcerting.
So yeah. So what you're pointing to is something that's really important to recognize. You know, there can definitely be physical sensations that mimic emotions. You know, like you said, you know, might just be an upset stomach, or it could be the other thing that I've seen is that when I've had a habit of certain emotional reactions, you know, I've gone into those emotional reactions over and over again. It's like the body can go into that pattern without the mind being involved. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's like there's no particular emotional reaction happening, but the body's gone into that pattern, and then the mind goes, oh, as you said, I must be, mm-hmm. and then it'll go off and create it because there's that belief, you mm-hmm. know, basically. So, you know, so what I've seen is that it's really helpful when you're feeling that physicality. I mean, that's a great reason for coming into the actual physical sensations when there is an emotion happening, because it begins to cut that feedback loop between the emotion and the body. And so you just, okay, so what's actually happening here? Okay, so there's contraction in the stomach and contraction in the throat and pressure under the eyes. I mean, so there are those physical sensations. And even if the emotion has already kind of started, that can help to, you know, allow us to back off. But just to begin to recognize, you know, sometimes these physical experiences can happen, and to be open, you know, to be open, like, well, what's going on, you know, to rather than, oh, you know, oh, I'm feeling a contraction in my heart, I must be lonely, you know, that kind of immediately leaping to that, oh, well, there's the feeling of contraction there, okay, what's, you know, what is that, what's going on? I have more than once had an experience where, you know, I've looked at something, well, one time I had belief that I was in a state of anxiety. I was in a situation typically produced anxiety. I was sitting waiting for an interview with my teacher on the 3-month course, and so it was like I've talked every third day, you know, so I was anxious often before that, you know, just about the fact of speaking, you know, what am I going to say to the teacher? What are they going to think? All of these thoughts would come and create some kind of a little bit of anxiety. And so when I would sit at the waiting for the teacher, I would observe these feelings. It's like, okay, that's happening. Okay, that's what's happening. One day while I was sitting waiting, I was feeling the feeling and labeling it, naming it as the emotion of anxiety. And the interview that I was waiting for to end went on for a really long time. So I got to watch this for a long time, this feeling. And the body was kind of quivery and shaky. And I was saying, well, there's anxiety. And, you know, not particularly reacting to it because, you know, I thought I understood the conditions around this. It's like, okay, yeah, I'm just anxious, okay. But by this point on the retreat, usually when I observed something for a long time, it diminished, or something shifted and changed around it. But it didn't change this time, and so I got a little more interested in what's going on here, and I began to actually more clearly pay attention to the physical sensations. So I started paying attention to the quivering in the body. And when I started doing that, there was all of these like really shock, sparky-like feelings kind of rising through the body really rapidly. And immediately I recognized, oh, this is rapture. This is not anxiety. It was.
How did you become mindful of it?
How did I become mindful of it being rapture?
Yes. Or the reality of the present moment where you were.
Well, I was aware of the feeling in the body, but what was going on was that there was a misunderstanding, a misconstruing of the emotion. So I was aware of what was happening.
Oh,
so there was mindfulness.
You're aware that you're making a mistake.
At that point, I became aware that there was a mistake. Yes, that I had been assigning it the wrong emotion. And so, you know, that kind of thing can happen to us. You know, physical experience can mimic other, many different emotions. So, you know, I kind of at this point, like, something happens, you know, it's like, I don't know what it is. I'm going to just hang out and look at it, to see what happens. So, yeah, so that's a really great point. And, you know, it's kind of like, it's the place of assigning meaning in a way. It's like, this feeling means. Like, I was in a situation in that case where the situation was one where I had felt anxiety before. So the context kind of set me up in a way. This time it didn't happen to be anxiety, but I was completely fooled because of a belief, of a view, of a meaning that was going on. Yeah, Victor.
How do you then guard against that pattern matching that sort of gave you that delusion of one thing when it was really another?
Well, you don't guard against it. You can't guard against it because it's just the process that happens.
So you're basically delusional until you're not.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, you just need to keep exploring.
Excuse me. It's like when you were thinking about the sound that you heard was pigs squealing.
Yes.
That really wasn't pigs squealing.
Right, but there was no way I could know that. I mean, that was just the pattern matching algorithm. It's like the
That's
squealing.
Right.
I hadn't experienced bats and squealing. You know, that wasn't in my experience.
Right.
Pigs and squealing, yes. So my pattern matching algorithm, that's where it went. Now it made a mistake.
Amen.
We can't really guard against that.
Then you're back to reality.
Right. We can't guard against that, but we can at the same time begin to not necessarily... that was an assumption, right? It was an assumption that was made in my mind. You know, oh, that's a pig. It was a pretty, you know, deep down there assumption. I don't know that we can really guard against it, but we can start to recognize when we have misperceived something. So, yeah. Sorry, there's not better news. And we need to stop. So thank you all for your attention.